Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back once again to Samuel Adams Returns, the Anti-Federalist. They absolutely got it right here on Liberty Works Radio Network, where liberty works for you. And this new year, yes, already a week into the new year, and it's still me, Tom Navolas, your host. I thank God that his mercy and grace is keeping me here, and I have the opportunity to be with you once again as we make this interesting time come to life in looking at the mirrors of history and seeing what was that which allows us to be what we should be today, and that which has been predicted, especially by the Anti-Federalists, that is brought us to what we are today. Well, there's several different things that I want to talk about today, one being oligarchy, throw in a little bit of the cabal, start the conversation that is going to be an ongoing topic for me, I think for maybe the rest of this month and into maybe a little bit next month, because it's so confusing, as well as there's so much information around there. And it is an interesting methodology called the Hegelian dialectic. And, you know, it's real interesting how that then ties into what is happening in what many of the pundits, even those pundits on Fox and in Congress and all of that, are calling the left, instead of calling them what they should have been called for the last 50 years, the communist. Are going crazy right now with this new administration that's coming in. And not just the communists, I'm going to say the dupes, those that are duped into all of the isms. So there's a lot there. This is not, once again, for those that get squeamish about utilizing the proper terminology. The fact of the matter is that the reality is that socialism, Fabianism, Gramsciism, and that is Gramsci, the Italian communist, which translates into Alinsky, who is the communist out of Chicago, which was a good friend of Obama's, one of his mentors, so on and so forth. None of this is, what do they call that? Where theories come to realities, and some people, you know what I'm talking about. No, we're talking about reality. We're talking about fact. We're talking about what we are now seeing that is happening all over the media, all over the cities, all over local governance, and that's really key. Stop right there. Local governance. We're seeing mayors and local officials taking stands that are contrary to constitutionalism, contrary to even the constitutions of their states, contrary to the very fundamentals of what it means to be a constitutional republic. And one has to remember, and I'm taking you back a little bit here, one has to remember that the Northwest Ordinance, and in the Constitution, says that when a new state would form, what are they promised? Can you answer that? What are they promised? They are promised a Republican form of governance. Now, that doesn't mean the Republican Party, because, you know, as we say, and as I write, and not all conservatives are constitutionalists, Republican Party has as many dupes, communists, and all of that in it as anything else. But let's get back to some of the things. I want to open up what I just found as a very interesting statistic. And this drives then to a lot of the rest of the conversation, in that the survey, the Pew survey of the new Congress, the 115th Congress, was asking the question, how many believe that they are Christians, or promote, or say, or define themselves to have a Christian fundamental background. and well, let's take fundamental out of it. Let's say that they use the term Christian in identifying themselves. So the new Pew report on the 115th Congress comes out and says that 9 out of 10 members of Congress consider themselves Christian. Now, that becomes extremely interesting to me because as I go back and I look at the founder's definition of what it meant to be Christian and how one interacted relative to governance, how they voted, those issues that would come forward from that concept and definition and how it was argued all the way through, we saw disparity then. We saw disparity that economics overruled belief. We saw that right at the beginning because when we looked at the slavery issue, if you will, that's an evil. It's an evil against mankind, always was. And the split between the North and the South in relationship to slavery was as much a issue of, or even more so, the greater issue over economics than it had to do with anything around a Christian belief system. Now, were they morally deficient from a Christian point of view relative to slavery? My opinion would be yes. Many's opinions would be yes. So then we take that and bring that into the modern context. And remember, that was a very contentious discussion during the Constitutional Convention. And remember, and this is where you have to frame this whole thing around the Constitution. We already had a Constitution. Remember that. We had the Articles of Confederation. And the issues and the deficiencies of the Articles of Confederation were more around commerce than anything else. And so when we look at even our present day, it always comes back to liberty versus economy, liberty versus commerce, liberty looking at it from a moral perspective and what will win out. Well, we will see here in a couple moments when I get into the Anti-Federalist Papers and talking about oligarchy and cabal and all of that, that it really came down to commerce winning out over liberty. Because as the arguments then went into effect around the Constitution as it was proposed in 87 and through the debates into 89, a lot of it was around liberty versus commercial activity, versus economy, versus internationalism. No different than we have today. But today, we have the greater component that's laid in there of the Gramsciites, the socialists, the Fabians, you know, the Alinskys, the Obamas, the Lindsey Grahams even, and the John McCains. I put them in that same category as I would a Fabian in so many regards. When it comes to globalism, it's about economy over it is liberty. And then when you look at the whole structure, I have to say, going back now to the Pew, and it was a lead up going back to the Pew poll there on the 115th Congress, the fundamentals of Christianity, the very fundamentals, 10 commandments alone, okay? I mean, that takes it straight across Judaism, and it takes it across into Christianity, and, you know, it just quite frankly, those alone are being violated, especially in the folks that call themselves Democrats. And I didn't find what I was looking for earlier because I ran out of time this week in putting together that and very, very clearly, because this is what we're seeing happening and it ties into the Hegelian dialect, is that I think it was about a year ago. And again, I don't have the article in front of me. I don't have the statement in front of me is that the Communist Party USA came out and said fundamentally that they own the Democratic Party. Now, I'm sure that the Democrats would freak out and say, "Oh no, that, we're not," but they're not. They say they're not. But when you see everything that they're doing, see everything they have been doing, if you look at the whole Obama administration, as I've been talking about since he came on site back in late 2008, 2009, when he announced, back then I absolutely proved that this guy, you know, was a Alinsky communist dupe, as well as all of those that have been tied into him are either Islamist or communist. It's just the way it is. I mean, you have to do your own homework, and I'm not apologizing for the terminology. I think we have too many light-footed and kind people, but that's where our real battle is, against good and evil. And you can see that even with this guy in the media yesterday, on Thursday, I guess, he was the former person for Bernie Sanders, something or another, led his campaign, talking about the atrocity there in Chicago, where people beat up, captured, held hostage, or held confined a person, and actually even scalped them. And he said that that wasn't evil. And he was trying to figure out what was going on with, you know, how these people were raised. Well, when people are raised without morality, when people are raised without God, when the isms take over education and everything else, then that's what you get. And it is evil. It is evil. And that's, again, what we then have to come back to in the Pew research is, okay, if 90% of Congress says that they're Christian, what does that mean? That means no different than what I asked the question around conservatism. What does it mean? What does it mean? And what I'd say is that not all conservatives are constitutionalists. So I will clearly say, based on how people vote, and what stands they take, in particular in the Democrat Party, is that if they vote for the things that they support, then they support evil. And what is it their definition of Christianity? And how can they align that with the fundamentals of biblical truth? So, you know, I'm sorry I took a lot of that up, but that drives right then to the whole ideas of cabal and oligarchy that are brought out in the Anti-Federalist Papers, and a lot of what Mercy Owens, a great female anti-federalist, had to talk about. And we're going to get into that a whole lot more in the next segment, but it's real interesting if we just go to you know, what was written in 1788, and it was a pamphlet titled The Aristocrats, and it came out in the an extract in the new federal about the new federal constitution. It was a satire. I mean, it really opens up on this whole issue that where's the moral substance in making a decision, and how does that maintain the ideas of liberty from that moral perspective? So I think it is an ongoing question. That not only what are conservatives, and how does that relate then to this constitution that was approved in 87, and we get into how the constitution has changed, and I talk about that in other areas, but mostly is the idea of, what does it mean to be Christian, and how can they vote as a Democrat for the things that are evil? They're things that are communist. That's the way it is. So, you know, as we get into this new year, and we get into the ideas of oligarchy, cabal, and Hegelian dialect, come on back here. It's Samuel Adams Returns, where the anti-federalists, you bet it, they got it right. Well, Happy New Year and welcome back once again to Samuel Adams Returns, the Anti-Federalist. Yeah, they absolutely got it right. Here on Liberty Works Radio Network, where liberty works for you, and this is your host, Tom Nivolis, and I'm delighted that you're back here for this next segment, and you're back here on Liberty Works Radio Network, which you know is a listener-funded network. To me, it's a ministry, and I think that there are a lot of great hosts and hostesses on this network, and I'd sure appreciate if you take the time to look around, as well as click on that button that says donate. You know what? Everything helps in keeping this network up and running. I'll tell you what, Dick, the producer, has been just a great guy. He's helped me out a lot. He's put this program together with all of the... I love the way that Dick has always wrapped each segment with a meaningful advertisement. It's so complimentary to everything that goes on in the program. And that takes a guy that knows his stuff to be able to do that and to make sure that everything gets going, everything gets and happens. So, Dick, Happy New Year. And, you know, just thanks a lot for everything that you do for the network. And, yeah, great work. Super technical stuff, which is beyond me. Anyway, let's get back to what we were talking about. And, you know, I gave you a real blast in that last segment. Two things, more than two, maybe four things, if I really count them correctly, is that I drove home the issue that is always going to be tied to in these conversations is that the Karl Marx took and utilized and actually perverted, if you will, the Hegelian dialectic. Because if you look at Hegel... amazingly enough, being I would call one of the transformationists, moving from Reformation and starting to get into more of a humanistic perspective, even on biblical theology, he had a theological background. But in the way that he was trying to reason, and this is where I always go off on academia, because I say it's very, very clear right from the beginning in Ecclesiastes that there's nothing new under the sun. And so when I look at reading a lot of moderns and then I look at the universities, and so you have all of these people running around trying to get a doctorate degree and trying to be come up with these new ideas or redefine ideas and all of that. Well, if you don't operate from absolutes and fundamentals, then you end up with the perversions of truth. And they may be that slight tweak of it. And that's what happened in kind of a easy way of looking at the Hegelian philosophy and the things that he wrote. I mean, you know, if you go in there, Hegel had some pretty interesting and quasi-solid perspectives from some theological points of view, but then he had to figure out, well, what's meaning? What's life? How do you transition an idea from one state to the next? What goes on with making that new truth? New truth. So then Marx took that new truth and he manipulated it in such a way that says, you know, I'm not trying to really get rid of religion. I'm just trying to show that, you know, religion, we got to get beyond the God component of religion. And we have to show that there is a pure human perspective of religion. Well, you know, anybody that's read the scriptures actually knows, especially in the Old Testament, the reason Satan fell was because, and I think it's in Ezekiel, is the reason Satan fell is because he tried to put himself above God. So what we have here is in trying to eliminate biblical truth and utilize the Hegelian dialectic methodology to derive a new rationale and a new truth, then you do exactly what biblical truth says is that Satan did. You try to elevate yourself, or man trying to elevate themselves into the position and throne of God. Simply that doesn't work. So that ties back then into the first segment and talking about, the 115th Congress. Pew Research came out and said that 9 out of 10 members in Congress said they're Christian. Well, what does that mean? And you can always tell, as Jesus said, someone by their fruits. So if you're taking and you're seeing that 90% say they're Christian, but also you have that 40+% that acts as a communist and look at the evils of socialism and humanism and all of that, and they function from that perspective, then what it means is that their Christianity, and this is an interpretation at my point, obviously I'm not God trying to place judgment. I'm just saying that you can observe and see how people function according to what would be established as a Reformation truths and baseline. And that's something the Reformation people had to deal with as well. But that gets into the whole idea then, that if you change the truth and you see that the narrative and the terminology is used extensively out there right now in the media, is what is the narrative? Well, the narrative becomes that which tries to manipulate or change a point of view or change a truism or change a fundamental baseline principle. That's using the Hegelian dialectic to move it, in particular with the Democrats, towards those Gramsci ideas. Next week, I'm going to get into it because I was looking at it very interestingly, briefly, actually, on Thursday and Friday, was that when we look at what Kozak wrote in Not a Shot Fired, that the idea that happened there in the Republic, the Czech Republic, and that was relative to a parliament and how much easier it is to flip a parliament into socialism and communism than it is remember, folks, we are a constitutional republic. So based on how we're supposed to function, that sets it apart. But where they learned and where the communists, the Gramsciites, the Kozaks, the Alinskyites, whatever you want to call them, I just call them communists because that's what they were, the Marxists, if you will, and now we're seeing the violence, so it is Marxism. So the point is that they were using continuing resolutions of not having a proper budget methodology. That was a way of subversion to take and manipulate our constitutional form of republic and institute the insanities and the evils of the isms. That's going to be another discussion maybe next week. But let's get back to the oligarchy and all of that. One of the things that really got me was that as I was going through Mercy and what she had to say, Mercy Otis Warren, as you've heard in other programs, was a predominant woman. She was a friend of Samuel Adams because her brother was his great friend. When you get to Mr. Otis, was just a phenomenal friend, and her husband was a friend also. So these guys were all connected, and Mercy was right in the middle of it. I mean, she was right there with the guy. She was actually, when you read the life of her and you find the intertwining of all the other players during the Revolution, Mercy was right there. She was like one of the guys. She was in the meetings. She was there. So, the whole thing that when she comes out as an anti-federalist, She does it in a manner that talks to, you know, what are the obvious truths that are being denied in this new constitution? You know, talking about how do you take and restore the public faith? She talks about, oh yeah, all right, so now you're trying to do it in a revival of commerce and the arts, agriculture, industry, under a lenient, peaceable, and energetic government. So what does that all mean? That means that here again, you're looking at economy versus liberty. But she comes into this interesting thing, and you know, how does this tie together? She kind of comes up and says, but the most sagacious advocates for the party have not by far, have not by fair discussion and rational argument evidenced the necessity of adopting this many-headed monster of such motley mixture that its enemies cannot trace a feature of democratic or republican extract, nor have its friends the courage to denominate a monarchy an aristocracy or an oligarchy, and the favored bantling must have passed through the short period of existence without a name, had not Mr. Wilson, in the fertility of his genius, suggested the happy epitaph of a federal republic. But I leave the field of general censure on the secrecy of its birth and the rapidity of its growth and the fatal consequences of suffering it to live to the age of maturity, and will particularize some of the most weighty objections to its passage through this continent in a gigantic size. It will be allowed by every one of the fundamental principles of free government is the equal representation of a free people. So when we get into the arguments that are coming about on the just election of Donald Trump, it comes down to what is the real free representation of the people, but more so, what is the morality? How does it work from the whole point that they argued, and this is much of what the anti-federalists argued, was that the presidency could very easily become a monarchy or an aristocracy. And we see that in the media every day is that, and just most recently, we see these with the $40 million book deal that Obama and his wife are getting, is we saw them all dressed up in robes as a king and queen, so there's an aristocracy. But the oligarchy that the anti-federalists really drive to is the Senate. And because of that relationship between the presidency and the functions of the Senate, the potentials of an oligarchy could be there. And since the 17th Amendment, which we've covered before, and I give you a lot of reference to, since the 17th Amendment, what we've seen is an oligarchy established in the Senate. And to the extent these guys have been in there way too long. So, you know, is there term limits? I don't think you need term limits. I think what you need to do is repeal the 17th Amendment. And what you'll get is you'll get rid of the oligarchy and it'll start to function as it should constitutionally. So this is what Mercy was talking about as well, is that over a period of time, you're going to see how this thing works out. And what we have has been established and through all of the isms as we've driven into the Senate being an oligarchy and leaving it wide open for cabal. And then what we've seen is from a moral perspective is that all of the isms have taken over in the respect especially to the Democrat Party, and that they don't even understand what the fundamentals of Christianity are, because if 9 out of 10 members of Congress would include the Democrats, is that they then, by virtue of those fundamental principles of the Ten Commandments alone within the context of Christianity, could not vote for all of the things that they vote for. So I think there's duplicity in what they say and what their definition of Christianity is. And as we get back into the next segment of Samuel Adams Returns, those anti-federalists, oh, they got it right. We're going to take it more into how that oligarchy allows and establishes itself for cabal. And this was a great concern of the anti-federalists of what cabal is. And boy, have we seen that in the next segment. Come on back. Looking at the potentials for some semblance, and I'm not going to say a total reality and objectivity towards a constitutional reform, but I think that we are going to move in a very strong semblance to try and bring this out of control federal beast into some semblance of what it means to drive on a constitutional administration. Whether we end up with a constitutional Congress will be something else. The expectation and the reasons that many went to elect Mr. Trump, because he was extremely strong on putting in a constitutional jurist. So when we look at the Supreme Court, the hope is that the jurist that goes in will have that very strong constructionist perspective on what the Constitution is supposed to function as, and hopefully as a constructionist from founders' intent. Believe it or not, as I even researched some people within the context of the Federalist Society, there are some that, you know, original intent is questionable because they don't look at the anti-federalist as the, even during the debates, the anti-federalists were supposed to have a larger interpretation of what was going on in constitutional effect relative to interpretation. And yet, we've not seen a lot of that in the jurist. So, with that said, the real point comes down to what we left off was on this idea of oligarchy. What the heck is oligarchy? And I was saying that the best way to take and hit term limits again would be to repeal the 17th Amendment. And absolutely, I think that is critical that somewhere, sometime, we the people would say, hey, get rid of the 17th Amendment. It's a bunch of baloney, because that established the oligarchy. So what's an oligarchy? Well, many of you, you know, right? You know that the oligarchy is a small group of people having control of a country, an organization, or an institution. So when you take and you start looking at the Senate and you look at what goes on in the Senate, this is exactly what the anti-federalists warned over and over and over again, that the Senate had the great potential to become an oligarchy, even in the way that it was designed from its origination prior to the debacle that the 17th Amendment created. Now, when you take and you look at what that oligarchy is, and excuse me, I have a little bit of congestion this morning. The thing that you have going on is that we see the anti-federalists talking about this, and let's see if I can get back to this particular reference. It was in the Kentucky Gazette in 1788. Republicus wrote, that was the anonymous writer, was talking about this whole idea, especially Article 2, Section 1, and went through on the executive power, where that would work and how that would go, and where suffrage and exactly what we're talking about. But then it moved into the whole thing is that the Senate, and he gets into this whole paragraph here and he's talking about it, and he goes on to say that, what were going to be the shadows that would come about? What are the what would happen through treaties? What would happen through all of these various alliances that would go on? So, that's what we're talking about, is that our government, our Constitution, has been perverted by exactly the concerns here of this anti-federalist, is what's going to be the private interest of the officers in the different departments that would come about. Boy, do we have a lot of that, especially in the likes of DOE, the EPA, you know, all of these other things. Where's the private interest in that? I'll tell you, talk about an oligarchy. DOE drives me crazy. You know, some of you know I've done some work and with the startups and the sustainability environment, and you know, it's a bunch of hokey pokey, except for trying to bring some true capitalism into the crazy regulations. Well, did you know in this first quarter of fiscal year 2017, which started in October with the federal government, that the DOE alone has already released $500 million of your taxpayer money into academia and research? That's ridiculous. $500 million and going to things that, you know what, in my opinion, if it's needed in private industry, let private industry go out there and figure it out and not you paying for it as a taxpayer. You know, I'm tired of that. You're getting ripped off, ladies and gentlemen, because then it goes into a lot of these international corporations you never see. Anyway, I'm going off track. The oligarchy, though, where you have the small controlling interest is what it's talking about. And let's see, let me back up and quote the relativeness of what he's talking about. Here is that upon his being invested with those powers for a second or third term, and this is even the president, he may acquire such enormous influence as, added to his uncontrollable power over the Army, Navy, and militia, together with his private interest in the officers of all of these various departments who are all being appointed by himself and to his creatures in the true political sense of the word, and more especially when added to this, he has the power of forming treaties and alliances and calling them to his assistance that he may, and I say, under these advantages and almost irresistible temptations of some pretended pick, haughtily and contemptuously turn our poor lower house over in such a way that the outer doors and give us laws at the bayonet point, or may not the Senate, who are nearly in the same situation with respect to the people, from similar motives and by similar means, erect themselves into an oligarchy towards which they have already attempted so large a stride. So what you see, and I can, you know, that is very interesting, that when people say Obama's stupid and all this stuff, no. When he studied the Constitution, he actually looked at the anti-federalist. You see, the communists, the Alinskyites, all of those that are against America and how to take it apart, actually studied the anti-federalist, in my opinion. And you know why? Because they found these types of issues and are using them in process with the Hegelian dialect to turn the Constitution of 1789, with all the treaties, with all of the things, what's happened with the UN, all of the stuff that's happened over the last couple hundred of years, they have, and I'm not just saying Obama, I'm taking it all the way back, even prior. I'm taking it back to 1912, 1913, when all of those that were of that mindset, I call them the anarchists, that when they looked at the anti-federalist papers, they said, oh, look, here's how we can use all of these things that were warned about against the American people and the Constitution. So I look at this establishment of the oligarchy. So when you take and you look at that whole time of 1913 and putting in the 17th Amendment, putting in the 16th Amendment, direct taxation of the people, all of that was against original intent. So then when you start looking at the presidency and questioning that, you see that come to fruition underneath the Obama administration, is that what you see is that having all these influences over all those that he appointed, well, first off, we've seen it with a lot of presidents where they come out millionaires, either by book deals or because of all of the other stuff. And we see that they come out millionaires because of all of the creatures that they created. And you see that, geez, K Street, now all those lobbyists, boy, you know, what's been hidden away to the extent that what's going on? Then with the formings of treaties and alliances and all of those components, you see, when we get into the more greater now of Agenda 2030 instead of Agenda 21, that right there is a tie. That's an alliance. Those are types of things that are now in that United Nations context, and the Senate going along with treaties, or, as I've talked about, is the executive administrative actions, which are, in effect, treaties by consent of earlier or by funding the activity, which is a whole nother discussion. You see, that goes into the continuing resolutions or continuing revolution by giving money to allow the insanity, as an example of this climate change stuff. Then that's the continuation of Agenda 21, not by direct consent, but by funding it. So these are the types of things that were brilliantly used against the American people by virtue of just this one anti-federalist paper. And in relative to the presidency and the establishment of an oligarchy within the Senate. So you see, ladies and gentlemen, it is very, very critical that we put our eye and effort not on the presidency. We have to put our eye and effort again on Congress. And for those that want to get involved in a really interesting program and very helpful, I tell you to join the Heritage Foundation Sentinel program. You know what? They need help. And they've got really good folks that are putting stuff together so that you can affect Congress. We have to. More than ever, the We the Peoples, the Tea Parties, every patriotic group has to come back together even stronger now and enlist people. I think you'll get people you never thought you were going to get, because you have to take and hold Congress absolutely accountable in becoming constitutional. So if they think that 9 out of 10 members of Congress function as a Christian, which I don't believe, because you can see right off the bat, Schumer and everybody, they're continuing the evil, and just everything that whole crowd that was standing around him just blew me away. No, Congress has to be held accountable so that any semblance of constitutionality that is coming in to the presidency has to become extensible now into Congress. And the only way that's going to happen is that if you know that not all those conservatives are constitutionalists, and if you are a constitutionalist, then you need to understand that, and you need to press that in to not only our national government, but, geez, the mayors and local. Come on back next week when we continue this conversation with Samuel Adams and the anti-federalists. They absolutely got it right here on Liberty Works Radio Network.